Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Dr. Katrina O'Sullivan. Good morning, Katrina.
Good morning.
And Katrina, a lot of people might not know you, but you have some story to tell. Will we start at the start, maybe? Tell me about your father, Tony.
Oh, yeah, my dad. So I grew up in the middle of England, an Irish family in the UK. My dad was, I suppose, probably one of my favourite people when I was a child. But unfortunately, my dad was a heroin addict, and he grew up here in Dublin in Leafy Clontarf, that's what they call it. But he was adopted. So he was in Golden Bridge for the first few years of his life. We don't really know the full story.
Yeah.
So my dad, I think before he even arrived to his lovely adoptive home, he had probably some trauma and some issues. And so my dad was this, I suppose, this vivacious character who loved life and lived life to the full. But unfortunately, he was also a drug addict. And so he was an Irish man. He moved to the UK and met my mum and had us kids there. But he was an addict.
Yeah. As you put it in your book, before he got his lovely middle class family, Tony had lost something and he never got that back. And then tell me about, so Tilly, your mother, her and Tony then were not good for each other, really.
You know what? It's a mixture. One of the reasons why I wrote Poor was because I really wanted to talk about the complexities of addiction, because, you know, we see people who are addicted and it's just, we just see one area of their life. Like, my parents were complex people and they were very loving, and there was a deep love between them, but it was very codependent. Like, the story is they met in Coventry at a bus stop, and my dad asked my mum for directions, and she gave him directions back to her flat, and he never left. But they weren't good for each other. I think in the long run they weren't good for each other. My mum was was very dependent on him, and he didn't treat her great. And I think he was dependent on her as well. And there was this toxic relationship between the two of them, and drugs were central to all of that. But there was love there as well. And there was music and there was laughter and there was so much more than just
the
addiction.
Yeah. And I mean, you said about Tony was he was fun and he was charismatic and he was all that as well. You know, we talk a lot these days about chaotic home lives and children brought up in chaos as a huge adverse childhood event. Like, you absolutely grew up seeing things that no child should see. Like one of the early scenes in the book is you remember seeing your father overdose.
Yeah, one of my earliest memories is walking into my dad's bedroom. You have to remember the context. Like, I'm living in a home where most days I'm watching my parents put needles in their arms, and there's no food, there's no electricity, heat, there's strange men in and out of the house drinking. So it was very chaotic. And while my dad was central to that, he also was my favourite person. Like, and when he was there was some relative stability in comparison to when he wasn't there. So, like, I really needed my dad. And we all need a parent. We all need love. And my dad, irrespective of how wild he was and the things he was doing, it was also really fun, and I loved being around him. And I remember this day walking into his bedroom, and you have to picture the scene. Like, the bed is, there's stains all over it, the room's in bits, but he was lying on the bed and there was a needle hanging out of his groin, and his skin is blue and white, and I just thought he was dead. Like, I'm 6 years of age in the house and I don't even hear my own voice, but I'm obviously screaming, you know, my dad is dead. And we had a lodger at the time, and he ran up the stairs and called the ambulance. But that was a really, you know, strong memory. But it's not, it's one of many memories like that.
I understand, yeah. It's a patchwork. Like, one little detail you give, for example, that kind of says so much, is that every spoon in the house was blackened from cooking heroin. You saw heroin as medicine, though, as a kid.
Yeah. So when you're a child, when you're witnessing someone being sick from heroin, like, my mum, when she didn't have it, was really sick. It looked like she was going to die to me. She was vomiting, and sweating and crying and able to move. So I knew this was the thing that made her better. And I used to want to get it for her because the fear of her dying, literally dying, was there. So I knew really early on that this was the medicine that made my mom not like sick on the sofa. And it was awful. Yeah, all the spoons were burned. It's funny, actually, because not people obviously live good lives. They don't understand how it even happens, how people take drugs. And so I had to explain that to people, what it means, what a blackened spoon is. But even as a young kid, my parents used to send us to the shop and we could only have like sweets that had tinfoil on them because they'd use the tinfoil to burn the heroin. I didn't know that. But then I remember realising that and even being angry about that, thinking even the rare treats that we get are surrounded by this, are connected to this addiction. But yeah, it was horrific. And I kind of used to want her to have it so that she was okay, because her without it was really traumatizing and scary, because I didn't realize that, you know, you could go a few weeks and then you'd be okay. I just used to see her in such pain and think, get it, whoever, please give it
mom,
to her.
Mom needs her medicine. Yeah. Yeah. And look, we'll come to in time now, you know, the learnings from all this and your development out of it and everything. But I'd say people are listening to all that and they're, how were you as a child in all of this? Like, what's going on in your little head?
I describe it in the book as being like you're on all the time. Like it's like there's this constant fear and you're kind of on edge constantly and afraid. Like I'm constantly terrified. I'm not kind of expecting bad things to happen. And so if you imagine I'm in school and I'm sitting there with all the other kids, having gone there without breakfast, hungry, messy, smelly clothes because I've wet the beds, and I'm trying to concentrate on what the teacher's telling me, but all I'm thinking is, what's happening at home? Is my mom okay? Is the police there? Has my dad been arrested? So it was like I kind of just had this really on. I was on and afraid and nervous.
The fire alarm is going off in your head all the time.
Yeah. But also, I'm also this like really innocent and vivacious little girl who loved to do cartwheels and play with her brothers, and I loved sport and was really focused. Like, it wasn't just that. So it was like there was so much more to me. But unfortunately, my parents' addiction and all the trauma that was in my house like stole that, because alongside all of the things that most little kids are, I'm also really terrified all the time and thinking, what's going to happen next? And I was like a little investigator. So I used to try to like search around the house to try to see what was coming next, who was knocking at the door, what was going to happen, because I was just really terrified all the time.
And nobody would blame you, because there are like constantly there are these stark moments where you, this little kid, is thrown into contrast with the reality of what was going on around you. Like, for example, you used to go down to the school, and over the school wall, you would kind of jeer at the sex workers on the street.
Yeah, so we used to think that was great crack when we were kids. There was a wall where the sex workers used to stand, and like we'd be like, "Come on, we go and get a chase off these women." It's probably not right, obviously, but we were just kids. We didn't know any better. And so one day, so it was this actually this Scottish woman who used to be up there. She'd give you a great chase if she was there. And so we'd be shouting things like £20 an hour. I had no clue even what that meant, but I was looking for the fun. And one day I remember actually going up and popping my head over the wall, and my mum is standing there. And I catch her eye and she catches my eye, and she's standing there, and I remember she had on this blue denim skirt, and she used to wear this skirt when she was trying to impress my dad. I used to remember she'd have blue eyeliner and this skirt, and she had it on and she was standing at the wall with all the other sex workers, and I knew what that meant. I didn't know what she was doing, but I knew it was really bad. And I ran home. I was so ashamed and so afraid and so embarrassed, and I ran home. And I ran into one of my siblings and I looked him in the face and I was like, "Mam is up there, you know." And he just had this flat look on his face. He already knew. And then all of a sudden, I was really aware that this was happening. Before actually seeing her, I didn't realise that the men that were coming in and out of our house, this is what this is what was going on. Like, they used to go upstairs with her, come back down. And then there was just this worse fear, because not only was she doing this thing that I knew was really bad, like, women were not supposed to do this thing, but also I was like, is my dad going to come home? Because my dad was in prison. So I thought that this meant, in my childish thinking, that it meant dad wasn't going to come back. And like, even though dad was bad, dad was nowhere near as bad as just mom on her own. So it was a horrendous time. And it was a horrendous time for my mom. Like, it's really important for me in writing the book to actually, you know, speak about my mom in a respectful way. Like, yeah. Poverty reproduces itself. My mom didn't come from an affluent background. She comes from poverty as well. She didn't have the skills to look after us or to be a mother. And at the end of the day, she had a mental health difficulty and she was unable to cope. So it's really important that my book kind of contextualizes that situation. Like, she's not the villain in this story. This was a woman who was desperate to look after her children and herself and her addiction. And she went to this place to do it. But the impact on me was that I was further terrified and further made vulnerable to other situations that probably wouldn't have happened if she hadn't have done that.
Mm-hmm. You were put into care at one stage, and I'm not sure, your siblings not so keen.
I loved it.
You loved it.
I have to look. We didn't get food. Okay, food's an issue for me. I love food, but like as kids, like, I didn't know if I was going to get a breakfast in the morning. You know, sugar sandwiches was a staple diet in our house. I hate them now, but like that was the limit of our nutrition. And also, I'm experiencing, trauma in our home in ways that might have been different actually to my siblings, and we've spoke about it, but it was different because I was a girl and I was vulnerable in the way that young girls can be, and the lads weren't. But I loved going into care. And I'm not saying, like, you know, it's ideal for people, but I was taken from this really chaotic place, really scary home, to like a place where, like, I had fresh clothes every day. There used to be this guy who'd come up and read me a story every night, and he'd do the voices. Yeah. He'd be like, and I was like, I love this. There's a story in the book where I talk about, so my brothers are like pinching me saying, do not enjoy this, we need to go home, because they're so loyal. And they were like saying that I wasn't loyal. I just didn't want to be in that horrible situation at home. So,
but there is huge loyalty, is there?
Yeah, there is. Like, you're taught very young to, like, as when you live a life like that, like, my parents were really afraid that we were going to get taken away from them, or our house was going to get taken from us, our council house, or our benefits were going to be taken. So there's a suspicion and a fear of, like, the affluent or the middle classes or the people in power that you learn really young. And so it's very hard to shake that off. But then also, when you meet them people, they treat you really badly. So they're not respectful to you. Like, I had policemen come into our home garden. They spoke to us children like we were dirt. Social workers who didn't treat us well, teachers. So it's like, it's a two-way street. I'm told not to trust, and then these people don't treat you very well. So we were taught to be loyal and keep things secret. But like, when we're in that care home, I loved it. Like, I remember there was this dinner that came along, where it plonked in front of us the first day there, and it was calves tongue. Never ate it since. I think it's the best meal I ever met ever in my life. But my brothers are there saying, do not eat that. And I'm looking, it's like a choice between food and them. And I'm like, I'm going for the food, lads, because this is beautiful and we don't know when we're going to get it again. And but like, I remember the lads saying to me, you know, you think you're better than us. Like, that was kind of the thing that they said. And we were better than that. Like, all kids are better than that at the end of the day. And it wasn't that I thought I was better. I just thought that we all were. And I didn't want to live in a miserable life. But yeah, care was great. And then we got sent home. And it makes me so angry that I've got my reports back. You know, some of them, they're redacted, but some of them. And like, you know, I was sent back to be further abused in my home. Like, my mom wasn't ready to take us back, and we were sent back, and worse things happen. And it makes me really mad that I wasn't cared for properly by the state. Like, my mom couldn't care for me, but the state could have cared for me in a better way. And I feel like they didn't. And that makes me really angry.
And then, okay, the next bit of the story, people might not want children to hear this bit, but like, the irony being it happened to you as a child. Was it after you were sent back home then? You talk about that you were on one hand this carefree little girl who did cartwheels and everything. that all ended when you were 7.
Yeah, so that actually happened before we went into care and then afterwards. So I was abused, I was raped as a 7-year-old, and I don't want to go into detail because it's very triggering probably for people listening, but I really struggled with whether I should write about this story because I didn't want my mum to come across as this really bad person. But the reality is kids who grow up in poverty are actually more likely to suffer what I suffered because we're vulnerable and not cared for. And people who are sick take advantage of that and see that. And so, yeah, I experienced abuse in our home. And the reason I wrote about that, a couple of reasons. First of all, like 1 in 4 people in Ireland have experienced this. That's why we have a charity called 1 in 4. And some of the shame that I feel and have felt around that is about the inability to talk about that and to say it. It's as if I did something wrong. And as a child, I felt like when that happened, it was a really splitting piece of my life. Like it fractured me in a way that was really deep. It took away, I suppose, any innocence that I had and any hope that I had, and actually sent me into this really deep feeling that there was something wrong with me. All these things were happening in my family, but this particular thing, I was like, I must have done something for this to happen. And there was nobody to go to. There was nobody to save me, I suppose, from that situation. And so I wrote.
And what's very telling is when you told your mother.
I told my mum, yeah. And she told me that he'd raped her too. And that was a horrific. It's a memory that I don't know if I'll ever fully recover from, in terms of like it's very strong. The moment it happened, I did the right thing. The right thing is to tell somebody. The mm-hmm. right thing is to tell your mum because she's supposed to care for you. But my mum obviously was experiencing what I was experiencing and was unable to do anything. I just remember her blank face and lack of response to it. Now, it's not in the book, but, you know, as an adult and when my mum was in recovery and trying to heal, we really returned to that moment a lot. And it was very difficult. My mum found it very difficult to forgive herself for that. And now I understand and feel a compassion for her. I still feel that little girl was let down, that I was let down, and it's awful. But I also really understand the broader context of what happened to my mother and think she had no skills and was unable to protect me. So I think it's really important to talk about that and also highlight the fact that kids in poverty are vulnerable to that, but also to say, I have nothing to be ashamed of. This mm-hmm. person did this to me. And I really genuinely believe when you meet a person, if you meet me, you know, we feel from each other that there's stuff. And why do we have to hide and be ashamed of things that have happened to us? So that's why I was so honest. And in the book, it is quite graphic. I talk about it really openly. I don't skirt over it. And the reason for that is because I actually think that's really important. This yeah. really horrific things happen to me, and it happens to other children as well.
So was it hard for you to work on the shame of not just that, but all of it? Did you have a lot of shame around everything?
Yeah. And to be honest, the reason I wrote this book as well is because there's this kind of idea that people just go from poverty to the life that I have now, the wonderful life, educated PhD lecturer. And there's this rags to riches kind of tale.
Yeah.
Like, I still feel shame. I still, like, it's a struggle. It's not as much now, but I've done a lot of therapy. I've had to work really hard to actually not feel like I'm ashamed. But there's a residual there, and it's always there. And I've had to learn how to manage that and heal from some of it, but it's still there. And I don't think it ever really goes away. It just integrates a bit more. And I feel a little bit more like the people who are responsible for the things they did, they have more responsibility now and I've less responsibility.
You became pregnant at 15. You say in the book this was your destiny, in a sense of that this cycle will keep repeating unless...
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, girls like me who grow up like I did, we generally, you know, a lot of us get pregnant young and, you know, we end up on the, you know, in council flats and cleaning jobs and social welfare payments. So, like, yeah, I think a lot of our destiny is set by where we come from, unfortunately, and or fortunately, depending on where you're born. And for me, the pregnancy, getting pregnant at 15, it was like, oh, like this is what this is what everybody thought was going to happen. I remember there were teachers who actually weren't surprised. Like that's what they thought was going to happen to me at the end of the day. And I think the pregnancy actually was the, one of the things that actually saved me, even though I wouldn't recommend it. Just putting that out there. Yeah. Don't get pregnant at 15, anybody. Yeah. It's really hard. It's hard at 30, but it's worse at 15. But having my son.
It didn't steady you initially. Though. No. Tilly said to you, your mother, like, I mean, the layers of irony and everything. Yeah. She said, this will settle you down. No,
I know.
But it didn't initially.
No. So actually, yeah, but how could it? Like, how could, I couldn't be a mother. I didn't have any skills. I'd literal or no capacity to actually get up and get on with the day most days.
Like, and you didn't know what a mother looked like.
No, kind of had no idea what I did have an idea from society. Like when we lived in Coventry, there was a lovely Irish family that lived next door to us, and the mother was fantastic. So obviously, I saw good mothering. Yeah, yeah. But like when you've grown up like I did, there's so much stuff underneath that drive us. It's not just about motivation. Like I wanted, like my mother wanted, to be an amazing mother, provide everything to my child, and be caring and give him everything that he needed. But I it was very difficult for me, and I ended up homeless, and I was living on the streets. I was squatting in a flat, and then was in a mother and baby home with my son, and that's where he was born, in a mother and baby hostel. But I still had lots of hopes and goals. I thought it would get better. I thought I would be better. But unfortunately, there was a lot of other stuff driving me that I hadn't resolved and I hadn't healed from.
And you say then that you ended up recreating the childhood that you had.
Yeah. So I didn't become a heroin addict, but I definitely developed addiction problems. I drank excessively, didn't pay my bills, was out partying more than staying at home. And I have this moment where I remember looking around my council flat. We've no electricity on. There's no electricity on. There's no carpet on the floor. I'm buying gas tokens on the Monday and they're gone by the Wednesday. And I'm looking at my beautiful son in the middle of this, and I have this like moment of like, I am them, I am her. With all the will in the world, I didn't want to be that person. But it's very hard to change your own life. It's very hard to change your own life. And the villain of my story actually, in some ways, became the hero, because my dad had found recovery in Ireland. He'd come back to Ireland. He'd ran away from Ireland, from England, because he was on on bail, and he'd gone back to Ireland, but he'd found recovery. And so he came actually and took my son here to Ireland, to Clontarf, and then provided me with a place to come and maybe rest a bit and then start the journey of recovery.
Yeah, and get out of your situation. And there's that extraordinary, like, it, as you say, the villain becoming the hero. That extraordinary moment when you sit down with Tony, your father, and you tell him your story for a few hours.
Yeah, that was, you know what though, like, as I said, I loved my dad. My dad was a great guy. If you knew Tony, he was really vivacious, could talk anyone around to anything. He's really, you know, open, and he wanted me to be better. Like, he was sorry. He still had issues, but that particular, so he wanted me to be better, and he really wanted my son to have a better life. Yeah. And so he made himself as available as possible. So at this one time, it was nothing big and dramatic. I told him everything, all the things I'd be doing, the drug taking, the drinking. And my dad really like supported me, encouraged me to go into the Rutland Centre and actually try to start making the changes that were needed to get a better life for us.
And the next step then, Tony, there, what you say, you didn't do this yourself. Interventions are important all the time here, that people intervene and at critical points and help you. But then getting into the access program in Trinity, obviously, was a huge game changer for you. But it's not a clear cut story.
No.
You and Trinity. I was reminded actually of, you know, this theory that what a privilege or a private elite education does for people, it's not about educating them, it's about giving them ease, EASE.
Yeah.
And that's what reinforces class.
Yeah, for sure.
And I thought of it reading about, like, who did you hang around with in Trinity?
I was the cleaners, the security guards, the canteen staff. They were my friends in Trinity. Like, you know, when I got into Trinity, so throughout my life, actually, like, I didn't get here on my own. And this is really important for me to say that. Like, I don't want anyone listening to think, sure, Katrina did it, that girl over there could do it. Like, there was so many people who intervened in my life, and it's in my book, who actually helped me get to where I am today. And there was a lot of system intervention as well. So I had a couple of great teachers who actually, as a child, really intervened. But then as an adult, I was able to recall that to be able to succeed in education. But Trinity, it was a really strange experience because, like, when you're poor, you have this idea of what's going on with middle class people, right? Posh people. Right. I call them poshies.
Yeah, what is it?
Actually, I was at the American Chambers dinner last night because we were nominated for an award. And it was exactly that. Like, they're in these ball gowns and they're very politely drinking wine at a table. And there's a minister doing a speech at the thing. And nobody's really messing or saying anything offensive to each other. But, like, you know, back then it was like they wore satchels and they'd been interrailing and they ate cool course. And there was, yeah, so I had these ideas about middle class people, and going to Trinity, like, it was pretty much confirmed, like, that there was, you know, I had this, there was this big difference in my life experience. But what was amazing about Trinity, and I'm so grateful to Trinity Access Program, but also for the education that Trinity gave me, because there was these two, like, I developed across two lines. Like, so the first thing I developed was, so I left school at 15 and most of my teachers treated me like I was stupid. And so I internalized that, like the leave insert. I'm not good enough. I'm not clever because I didn't get GCSEs or A-level or leave insert points. So I spent my life going, I'm going to be a cleaner. I worked in the Institute as a dinner lady. I was a cleaner in Connolly Station. There was nothing better for me. And then I went to Trinity, this brilliant place. And I'm like, amazing. I'm getting 2 ones and firsts. I'm like, yeah. And I'm like, that was all a lie. I'm, you know, I want to swear. I'm not going to swear on the radio, but I do swear a lot. And I was like, I am deadly. And that feeling is unreal. So I've got this development going on where my self-esteem is growing and my life is getting better and my mind is growing. But then alongside that, it's like I'm looking at all these other students and the staff and all the affluence and all of their experience. And I'm like feeling so different and actually so sad for, like, all the other people in my community who just don't get to feel the things that I'm feeling and realize what they can do and be. And so, like, it's a real hard place to be. It's like, there's one story. I was the dinner lady in the Institute. And then when I started in Trinity, one of the girls who I used to serve sausage rolls to was in my class. And she came up to me on the first day. She's like, oh, my God, what are you doing here? And I was like, oh, you know, I just said to her, you know, dinner ladies have brains too, you know, like, to make a joke of it. She's like, of course, well done. And she wasn't mean or anything. But, like, there's this, you know, there's this divide between what people think they can be and what people think they can do on both sides. And in my case, I realized from my education, wow, how rigged the system is against people like me.
Tell me about that day you were stacking or unstacking chairs in a lecture hall.
Yeah, so I actually excelled. I graduated with a first class honours from psychology, got a PhD scholarship. And, like, during my time in Trinity, I was like, I need to start, like, dressing like them and speaking like them. So I was, like, wearing these warehouse dresses, modest clothes, you call it. That's what they dress like. There's a uniform for class as well, you know, and language one of them.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to, like, fit in, and I'm angry at myself for not being myself. And then I got this lecturing job in psychology. I was so delighted with myself. I'm like, I'm going to be myself. I'm going to wear my hoops, my tan, my ripped jeans. I'm not going to be, like, trying to be like one of them. And my lecture's about to start, and I'm cleaning up because the lecturer before hadn't cleaned up his mess from the stage. So I'm in the arts block and I'm moving the chairs to get ready to speak. I'm already nervous because, you know, they're quite affluent, the kids are, you know, they know a lot, like, they ask hard questions. And this student came up, excuse me, there's a lecturer on here now. And I turned to her and I was like, I am the lecturer. And she was like, oh, okay, it's fine. And she thought I was the cleaner, like, because of what I was wearing, obviously, and how I looked. She thought I was the cleaner. But it was a real moment of, like, it's very difficult to be yourself. Very difficult to be yourself in a place that's just completely designed for a specific group of people. And I used to think, oh, it's not their fault. They don't know. But actually, if you've the privilege of an education, then you have the ability to think critically. And if you've got that ability, you know that this is rigged. And you're either holding up the system or you're helping to make it fairer. And so it kind of drove me into the career that I'm in now, which is to try to make it fairer. Like, I'm using my privilege to actually try to make things fairer. That's why I've written the book, because I feel in a position that I can actually talk about my story and maybe inspire someone, but maybe also challenge someone.
Yeah. And you're quite challenging about, look, the Trinity Access Program people aren't here now, but you're entitled to your opinion on it. I know you're very grateful for it. But you question now the kind of, almost like there's a Victorian element of charity and moral kind of stuff.
It's not just Trinity. So it's any, it's so the idea that poor people need saving is infuriating to me. And I never knew that before. So actually, like, as a student of the Trinity Access Programme, I actually got so much support and care, and I wouldn't be here without it. But what happened is I became really educated and understood society. And I used to go and speak at dinners, stand up, like, and say, oh, like, thank you for saving me. Like, I was so broken and now I'm here. And then as I began to, like, get my PhD and contribute and get grants, I'm like, I'm actually contributing here. Like, this place needs me. I'm not a broken person that needed to be fixed by this institution. Actually, the institution needed to be fixed in order so I could thrive in here. And so the idea of charity bothers me. And that's not just in Trinity. It's in any, I suppose, philanthropic.
Yeah, and look, we'll say that the people who are doing the Trinity Access Program, they're doing a great job, and they're doing it for the right reasons and everything. But you're questioning the philosophy that underpins all these kind of things.
Any of the funding models, especially the way we try to get people to buy into poverty, to charity, to save people. We should be looking at how skilled I am, how skilled we are, and trying to empower us to participate fully in society, I suppose.
Yeah. You kind of say that there's this model now, take it away from Trinity, which is like, you prove that you're poor, prove that you're deserving poor, and you call it rescued from the clutches of your own community.
I know, and it's funny, but even now, like, it's you know, one thing that's really worrying for me is if it was today, so I was really lucky that I was looking to change my life in the Celtic Tiger. So when we are in a boom and there's money, it trickles down and the poor, they start trying to save the poor, which is great. So I was able to avail of grants, childcare support. You could actually start a course then and drop out and then do another course. But all that's gone. Nowadays, you have to even go to the social welfare and justify what degree program you're going to take and prove that it's going to get you a job at the end of it, because it's so restrictive now. So it is a problem. And I think we need to be braver and recognise that, like, education in of itself is valuable because it helps you think differently irrespective of the job you get. And then also consider, like, how do we make sure that all of us are able to access this wonderful education that I was able to access.
So then in the meantime, both your parents died at different times. And you know, you've made it very clear you loved them and everything. But you were relieved.
Yeah.
When they died?
Especially when my mum died. It's funny, when people die, we're not really allowed to say that, you know. But my mum couldn't recover. She continued to use drugs and drink all my life. And so she was never still enough for me to actually get over the things that she had done. And so it kept piling on. And when she died, it just all stopped. And the heavy drama that she brought into my life was over. And so I was relieved. And I don't know if I'd have been able to have found as much freedom as I have now in my emotional self if she was still here. And that's an awful thing to say, because, like, I would love her to be here and her to be well and her to have been able to find freedom, but she couldn't. The thing with my mum was that she had done so much. I think any time that she got sober and clean, the guilt of having to witness the impact that she'd had on her children's life was too much for her to handle. And so she went back all the time. And so it was a relief. And I remember saying that quite quickly after she died, I'm so glad she's dead, to somebody just offhand. I didn't mean it in a bad way. And they were like, really, you're not allowed to say that. And I was like, well, I actually feel that. I'm glad that it's over.
Yeah.
Not that she's not here. But the sad thing was, it's like that little 7-year-old girl who I dedicated my book to, like she is still here in me, you know, and she always hoped that her mum would love her and her mum would do the right thing by her. And when my mum actually died, that hope died. And that's what I grieved for in a lot. I grieved for maybe the future that we could have had, maybe the restoration we could have had. That was really tough when she died.
You do think she loved you?
Oh, I know she loved me. I actually asked her. So I love Eminem. I'm sitting here with Tupac t-shirt on, but I love Eminem. And when I was postdocing in Trinity, I was sitting in my office and I was listening to an Eminem song called Headlights. It's about his mother. And I just got inspired. I'd been in therapy a good while then, but I really got like, I just thought I need to ask her if she ever loved me. And I went and rang her. And I was like, Mom, can I speak to you for a minute? And usually our conversations were quite defensive. Like I'm outward, as you can probably tell. My nickname was Mouth as a child.
Right.
I'm pretty direct. And so like for an addict who's, I would say it and she didn't like it. So there was always this tension between us. So I rang her and she was quite tense. And I was like, Mom, I just need to ask you a question. Are you okay for me to ask you? And she was like, yeah. I was like, did you ever love me? And she said, oh my God, you know, my Katrina, I loved you so much. I just loved Gear more. And in that moment, I actually felt just like a letting go. I knew she loved me. Even when she was, you know, selling herself, she told me, you know, all I used to think was, I just have to get enough money for chips for the kids and gear for me. And that was her motto. And so whether that sounds, and I know that sounds shocking probably for the listener, but for me, I was like, she was always trying. She just didn't have the skills to do what she needed to do. And what I needed, she didn't have the skills to give me that.
Yeah. And look, I mean, I'm aware that I kind of got you to tell me a lot of tough stories about yourself there, but the book, it's not misery lit. There's so much more to it than that. I kind of think they should put it on the Leaving Cert actually, because it's full of extraordinary insights. But I think, is your central point, and the book is called Poor, is your central point that all this happened to ye and all this happened to your parents because you were poor? Bottom line, it's as simple as that. And it's addiction, poverty, these things are not moral failures.
100%. Yeah. And I called it poor for a number of reasons, because I grew up poor, but also because the system is poor. And the system that's in place, that, you know, the system could be better in terms of. So, yeah, my book is not a misery story. There's loads of lightness and fun in it and happiness. But also it actually tells the story of how I actually was able to escape poverty. And the way I escaped poverty has been great people who intervened in my story at really pivotal points. So like one of the really important things was to have three therapy available when I asked for it, to have grants in place, to have the access program on offer for somebody like me. So all these things were really available back then that are not there now. So like my story is that, and that, yeah, it's very difficult to escape poverty. And we lived poor, and that poverty, I suppose, underpins everything that I've been through. Addiction, family, abuse. And then also, I think I'm privileged now to have lived through poverty. I have a voice. I have the capacity to speak for the community that I come from. And also I'm able to actually influence policy and practices within education that I wouldn't be able to if I hadn't have been through what I've been through. So I kind of feel privileged as well as poor at times.
Yeah. Do you still feel poor at times? Like, have you been able to overcome all that damage, or is that a daily struggle?
It isn't. No, I have a great life.
Yeah.
Like, I have a great home. I have a happy marriage. Like, that's one of the things that I was saying before coming on the show. Like, my message is like, I'm really happy.
Yeah.
Like, I'm really happy. Me and my husband, we love each other. We have wonderful kids. I have a lovely grandson. Like, I swim in the sea and I lecture and I have great relationships with friends. Like, I've recovered. But there is a residual. There's always a residual when you've been through hard stuff. And sometimes that residual is more harder for me to manage. And I have mechanisms which I put in place in order to support myself when that happens. One of them's therapy. The other one's sea swimming. Sometimes I go on a run if I can. And life is really good for me. And it can be good. That's my message as well. It's like, you might have been through stuff, but like, it's possible to be happy. And I've wrote about how I've become happy.
Yeah. But you didn't do it on your own.
No.
You didn't do it without the help. Listen, so many texts and so many people calling you heroic and inspirational, brave and compassionate. She's a feckin' star, says this texter. It's an extraordinary story, Katrina, and it's
thank
an
you.
Extraordinary book. And thank you so much for sharing it with us. And it's Poor, The Life Story of Katrina O'Sullivan, is published by Penguin and is in bookshops now. Dr. Katrina O'Sullivan, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.